Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we become one with nature. Trees and other plants can be grown almost anywhere, even in big cities. A relatively small but thick forest is growing near Washington, D.C. It can be found off a busy road in Maryland. Marcia James tells us about one Maryland community that is enjoying the quality of life and other benefits of plants, one tree at a time.
2,400 people live in the town of Forest Heights. Their neighborhood overlooks the road that many of them take to work. There is no city or business center. Only few service stations, carry out restaurants, and liquor stores. What Forest Heights does have is a can-do leader, Mayor Jacqueline Goodall, a woman with a vision.
My vision for our town is to be the greenest town in Maryland. Matter of fact, Forest Heights was green before green was green.
Trees are central to that plan. 150 young people are helping to prepare land for 500 trees. All of them are students from the University of Maryland. They are working near an elementary school in an area that often floods after heavy rainfall. Mayor Goodall wants the students to make sure they remove unwanted plant life. Trees growing in this area can help protect the school grounds and nearby homes when it rains. Jacqueline Goodall says the homeowner reaps even more benefits. Ann Buckaloo is a scientist with the U.S. Forest Service. She stopped by to inspect Mayor Goodall's progress in urban forestry.
You know, if we want to address the stormwater issue, there's things that we must do. Planting trees is one of them.
Exactly.
Educating our citizens on what they need to be doing on their property.
Ann Buckaloo says as people begin to see trees as something of value, cities become richer and more livable. Mayor Goodall started her planting campaign in 2008, when she was still just a member of the town council. The tree canopy covered only 37% of Forest Heights at the time. Since then, she has turned the local government building into an urban forest and planted 1,100 street trees in front of homes. She says as they grow, they will increase property values, reduce atmospheric pollutants, and aid with storm water retention. Mayor Goodall estimates that is worth about $3 million to the town. Betty Wilson and her neighbors now live on tree-lined streets. Mayor Goodall says the goal is to increase understanding about health and the economic and ecosystem services that trees provide. Her hope is that Forest Heights lives up to its name by covering its streets with a green canopy. I'm Marcia James.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. America's 50th state, Hawaii, recently suffered two large, rare storms. The high winds and heavy rains left plant scientists hoping that the island's most unusual plants survived. Mario Ritter has more on what one expert is doing to help save those plants in Hawaii.
America's 50th state, Hawaii, recently suffered two large, rare storms. The high winds and heavy rains left plant scientists hoping that the island's most unusual plants survived. The state is home to many native plants. They include 1,200 species, 90% of which are not found anywhere else in the world. But Hawaii also has become the endangered species capital of the United States. Nearly 40% of the plants on that endangered list grow in Hawaii. Its natural heritage has been disappearing because plants and animals from other areas have invaded. Experts also blame agriculture, development, and natural events that cannot be predicted. Field plant expert Steve Perlman has led protection of Hawaii's endangered species for more than 40 years. He is one of the state's first rock star botanists. In the 1970s, he rappelled, using ropes around his body, to swing down from high cliffs to save the Brigamia insignis. People call this rare Hawaiian plant Alula. Then Mr. Perlman started to use those same methods of climbing and hanging from cliffs to get to other plants. He is now in his 60s, but he is still rappelling off cliffs to save endangered plants. The rescued plants are varieties, or kinds, that have established themselves in places where hungry animals, like goats and pigs, could not get them. He says it is worth it to see a species survive. After a long career as a field botanist at the National Tropical Botanical Garden, he is now the statewide specialist for Hawaii's Plant Extinction Prevention Program. The program centers on protecting species with fewer than 50 plants remaining in the wild. Mr. Perlman also continues to discover new species through his work. The Hibiscadelphus trees are an example he and others found growing in a steep valley on the island of Maui. His explorations often take him to places that have not been touched. I'm Mario Ritter.
And that's our program for today. Join us tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. This week, the United States Congress approved part of President Barack Obama's plan to defeat Islamic State militants. The Senate voted Thursday to equip and train moderate Syrian rebels to fight the militant group. The measure was tied to a bill that will guarantee money to pay for U.S. government operations into December. The vote came a day after the House of Representatives agreed to help the Syrian rebels against the Islamic State, also known as ISIL or ISIS. The measure represents the only action U.S. lawmakers are likely to take before congressional elections in November. Florida Senator Bill Nelson is a member of Mr. Obama's Democratic Party. He compared the effort against the militants to fighting a wild animal.
When it comes to Syria, and that's where the head of the ISIS snake is, and if you're going to kill the snake, you've got to go to where the head is and chop it off.
The Islamic State has seized parts of Syria and Iraq. The Wall Street Journal newspaper says more than 8 million people live in areas under the group's control. How do the Islamic State militants get money to support their operations? Observers say some money comes from kidnapping, human trafficking, and the secret movement of goods across borders. Other financing reportedly comes as a result of threats made to local officials and businesses. But most of the money comes from sales of oil, often to secret buyers. U.S. intelligence officials and observers say the militant group earns at least $1 million a day from such sales. Howard Schatz is with the RAND Corporation, a public policy group. He has studied the Islamic State. In his opinion, the group is operating as a state, but it is a criminal state. Islamists set their sights on the area's oil industry years ago. Mr. Schatz says they made threats to employees at the Beji oil refinery in northern Iraq. They reportedly collected about $2 billion from the employees between 2006 and 2009. The Associated Press news agency estimates that Islamic State forces controlled 11 oil fields in Iraq and Syria as of last weekend. The United States is using airstrikes and political pressure in hopes of stopping the oil sales. In Washington, a State Department official told reporters earlier this month that "We believe that oil smuggled out by trucks through the Jordanian and Turkish borders is a serious problem." He added that both those countries have pledged to do all they can to stop it. Observers say recent videos of the Islamic State executing hostages have more than propaganda value. They say the images also serve as ransom notes for other kidnapped victims. The United States and Britain have repeatedly said they do not make payments for the release of their citizens. But some countries do. Last month, CBS News reported that a European company paid a $70,000 ransom for a kidnapped employee. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Purloined Letter. It was written by Edgar Allan Poe. Poe is generally known for his horror stories. This is the third of three stories he wrote about Auguste Dupin and how he solves crimes. The story is about a stolen letter. It first appeared in 1844 in a yearly magazine. It was reprinted in many publications, newspapers, and books. This is one of Poe's stories that influenced the development of the modern detective story. Here is Shep O'Neill with The Purloined Letter.
One evening in Paris, during the autumn of 1845, I went to visit a friend, Auguste Dupin. We were smoking our pipes and talking when the door of his apartment opened. Mr. Germain, the head of the Paris police force, came into the room. "I came to ask your advice," Germain said to my friend Dupin. "I'm trying to solve a very important case. It is also a very simple case, so I really need your help. But I thought you would like to hear about it, because it is so strange. My men and I have worked on this case for 3 months, as Germain said. It is a very simple case of robbery, but we still cannot solve it." Dupin took the pipe out of his mouth. "Perhaps the mystery is too simple," he said. Germain began to laugh. "Too simple," he said. "Who ever heard of such a thing?" I looked at Germain. "Why don't you tell us the problem?" I said. Germain stopped laughing and sat down. "All right," he said. "But you must never tell anyone I told you this. The wife of a very important person needs help. I cannot tell you her name, because her husband is a powerful man in the French government. Let us just call her Madame X. 3 months ago, someone stole a letter from Madame X. She is offering a large amount of money to anyone who can return the letter to her. We know that her husband's political enemy, Mr. Darcy, stole the letter. We also know it is somewhere in his apartment. Darcy plans to use the letter to embarrass Madame X's husband and destroy his political power. As you know, I have keys which can open any lock in Paris. For the last 3 months, my men and I have spent every evening looking for the letter in his apartment, but we cannot find it." Dupin stopped smoking. "Tell me how you looked for it," he said. Germain moved forward in his chair. "We took our time," he said. "First, we examined the furniture in every room. We opened all the drawers. We looked under the rugs. We searched behind all the paintings on the walls. We opened every book. We removed the boards of the floor. We even took the tops off the tables to see if he had hidden the letter in the table legs. But we cannot find it. What do you advise me to do?" Dupin puffed on his pipe. "What does the letter look like?" he asked. "It is in a white envelope with a red stamp," Germain said. "The address is written in large black letters." Dupin puffed on his pipe again. "I advise you to go back and search the apartment again," he said. About 1 month later, Germain came back to see us.
I followed your advice, he said, but I still have not found the letter.
Dupin smiled.
I knew you would not find it, he said. Germont became very red in the face. Then why did you make me search the apartment again? He shouted. My dear Germont, Dupin said, let me tell you a little story. Do you remember the famous Dr. Louis Abernathy? No, Germont shouted. Get to the point, Dupin. Of course, Dupin said. Once a rich old man met Abernathy at a party. The old man was not feeling very well. He decided he would get a medical opinion from the doctor without paying for it. So he described his problems to Abernathy. Now, doctor, the old man said, suppose you had a patient like that. What would you tell him to take? Oh, that is quite simple, said Abernathy. I would tell him to take my advice. Germont looked embarrassed. Look here, Dupin, I'm perfectly willing to pay for advice. Dupin smiled at Germont. How much money did you say the reward was? He asked. Germont sighed. I do not want to tell you the exact amount, but I would give 50,000 francs to the person who helps me find that letter. In that case, Dupin said, take out your checkbook and write me a check for 50,000 francs. When you have signed the check, I will give you the letter. Germont looked at Dupin with his mouth open. His eyes seemed to jump out of his head. Then he took out his checkbook and pen and wrote a check for 50,000 francs. He gave it to Dupin. My friend examined the check carefully and put it in his pocket. Then he unlocked a drawer of his desk, took out the letter, and gave it to Germont. The policeman's hands shook as he opened the letter. He read it quickly. Then he put it in his pocket and ran out of the room without saying a word. Dupin, I said, as I turned to my friend, how did you solve the mystery? It was simple, my friend, he said. Germont and his policeman could not find the letter, because they did not try to understand the mind of the man who stole it. Instead, they looked for the letter where they would have hidden it. Mr. Darcy is not a policeman. He is, however, very intelligent. He knew the police would search his apartment. He also knew how police think, so he did not hide the letter where he knew they would look for it. Do you remember how Germont laughed when I said the mystery was difficult for him to solve because it was so simple? Dupin filled his pipe with tobacco and lit it. Well, the more I thought about it, the more I realized the police could not find the letter, because Darcy had not hidden it at all. So I went to visit Darcy in his apartment. I took a pair of dark green eyeglasses with me. I explained to him that I was having trouble with my eyes and needed to wear the dark glasses at all times. He believed me. The glasses permitted me to look around the apartment while I seemed only to be talking to him. I paid special attention to a large desk where there were a lot of papers and books. However, I saw nothing suspicious there. After a few minutes, however, I noticed a small shelf over the fireplace, a few postcards, and a letter were lying on the shelf. The letter looked very old and dirty. As soon as I saw this letter, I decided it must be the one I was looking for. It must be, even though it was completely different from the one Germain had described. This letter had a large green stamp on it. The address was written in small letters, in blue ink. I memorized every detail of the letter while I talked to Darcy. Then, when he was not looking, I dropped one of my gloves on the floor under my chair. The next morning, I stopped at his apartment to look for my glove. While we were talking, we heard people shouting in the street. Darcy went to the window and looked out. Quickly, I stepped to the shelf and put the letter in my pocket. Then, I replaced it with a letter that looked exactly like it, which I had taken with me. I had made it the night before. The trouble in the street was caused by a man who had almost been run over by a horse and carriage. He was not hurt, and soon the crowd of people went away. When it was over, Darcy came away from the window. I said goodbye and left. The man who almost had an accident was one of my servants. I had paid him to create the incident. Dupin stopped talking to light his pipe. I did not understand. "But Dupin," I said, "why did you go to the trouble of replacing the letter? Why not just take it and leave?" Dupin smiled. "Darcy is a dangerous man," he said, "and he has many loyal servants. If I had taken the letter, I might never have left his apartment alive."
The Purloin by Edgar Allan Poe and adapted into Special English by Donna DeSanctis. The storyteller was Shep O'Neill. The producer was Lawan Davis. You can read and listen to other American stories at our website, voaspecialenglish.com. I'm Barbara Klein.